Chapter 6. It was still 3 in the morning when Isaac Bell bounded off the train before it stopped rolling onto the waterfront terminal on Oakland Mall. This was the end of the line for westbound passengers, a mile-long arm of rock that the Southern Pacific Railroad had built into San Francisco Bay. The pier reached another mile into the bay to deliver freight trains to seagoing vessels and boxcar floats to the city, but passengers transferred here to their ferry. Bell ran for the ferry, scanning the bustling terminal for Lori March, the old farm woman from whom he always bought flowers. Nestled in the bottom of his watch pocket was a small, flat key to Marion Morgan's apartment. Drowsy newsboys with seeds in their hair from the hay barges where they slept were crying in shrill voices, "Extra! Extra!" and waving special editions of every newspaper printed in San Francisco. The first headline to rivet Isaac Bell's eye stopped him dead. Train wreckers ditch Coastline Limited at Glendale. Bell felt as if he'd taken a bowie knife in the stomach. Glendale was 700 miles from the Cascades cutoff.
"Mr. Bell, sir? Mr. Bell?"
Right behind the newsboy was an operative from Van Dorn's San Francisco office. He didn't look much older than the kid hawking the papers. His brown hair was pillow-flattened against his head, and he had a sleep wrinkle still creasing his cheek. But his bright blue eyes were wide with excitement.
"I'm Dashwood, Mr. Bell, San Francisco office. Mr. Bronson left me in charge when he took everyone to Sacramento. They won't be back until tomorrow."
"What do you know about the Limited?"
"I just spoke with the railway police supervisor here in Oakland. It looks like they dynamited the locomotive, blew it right off the tracks."
"How many killed?"
6 so far, 50 injured, some missing."
"When's the next train to Los Angeles?"
"There's a flyer leaving in 10 minutes.
"I'll be on it. Telephone the Los Angeles office. Tell them I said to get to the wreck and don't let anyone touch anything, including the police." Young Dashwood leaned in close, as if to impart information not privy to the newsboys, and whispered,
"The police think the train wrecker was killed in the explosion."
"What?"
"A union agitator named William Wright. Obviously a radical."
"Who says?"
"Everybody."
Isaac Bell cast a cold eye on the kaleidoscope of headlines that the newsboys were brandishing. "Deed of Dastards. Death List Swells. 20 Lives Lost. Train Wreckers Dynamite Locomotive. Express Plunges into Riverbed." He suspected that the closest to actual fact was "Express Plunges into Riverbed." How it happened was speculation. How could they possibly know the death toll of a wreck that happened just hours ago, 500 miles away? He was not surprised that the lurid headline, "Death List Swells, 20 Lives Lost, was splashed on a newspaper owned by yellow journalist Preston Whiteway, a man who never let facts get in the way of sales. Marion Morgan had just started to work as the assistant to the editor of his San Francisco Inquirer.
"Dashwood, what's your given name?"
"Jimmy."
"James."
"Okay, James. Here's what I want you to do. Find out everything about Mr. William Wright that everybody doesn't know. What union does he belong to? Is he an official of that union? What have the police arrested him for? What are his grievances? Who are his associates?" Staring down at the smaller man, he fixed James Dashwood in a powerful gaze. "Can you do that for me?"
"Yes, sir."
"It's vital that we know whether he worked alone or with a gang. You have my authority to call on every Van Dorn operative you need to help you. Wire your report to me care of the Southern Pacific's Burbank station. I'll read it when I get off the train." As the Los Angeles flyer steamed from the piers, the fog was thick, and Isaac Bell looked in vain for the electric lights of San Francisco twinkling across the bay. He checked his watch that the train had departed on time. When he returned the watch to its pocket, he felt the brass key that shared the same space. He had planned to surprise Marion with a middle-of-the-night visit. Instead, he was the one surprised. badly surprised. The wrecker's reach extended much further than he had presumed, and more innocent people had died. The sharp Southern California noonday sun illuminated wreckage unlike any Isaac Bell had ever seen. The front of the Coastline Limited's locomotive stood pitched forward, intact, at a steep angle in a dry riverbed at the bottom of the railroad embankment. The cow catcher in the ground and the headlight and smokestack were readily identifiable. Behind them, where the rest of the locomotive should be, all that remained was a crazy spiderweb of boiler tubes, scores of pipes twisted at every angle imaginable. Some 90 tons of steel boiler, brick firebox, cab, pistons, and drive wheels had disappeared.
"Close shave for the passengers," said the director of maintenance and operations for Southern Pacific, who was showing Bell around. He was a portly, pot-bellied man in a sober 3-piece suit, and he seemed genuinely surprised that the death toll had not been much higher than the now confirmed 7. The passengers had already been taken to Los Angeles on a relief train. The Southern Pacific's special hospital car stood unused on the main line, its doctor and nurse with little to do but bandage the occasional cut suffered by the track crews, repairing the damage to reopen the line.
9 of the cars held to the rails, the director explained. The tender and baggage car shielded them from the full force of the explosion. Bell could see how they had deflected the shockwave and the flying debris. The tender, with its cargo spilled from its demolished sides, looked more like a coal pile than rolling stock. The baggage car was riddled as if it had been shelled by artillery, but he saw none of the singeing associated with an explosion of dynamite. Dynamite never blew a locomotive like that.
"Of course not. You're looking at the effects of a boiler explosion. Water sloshed forward when she tipped and the crown sheet failed.
So she derailed first."
"Appears she did."
Bell fixed him with a cold stare. "A passenger reported she was running very fast and hitting the curves hard."
"Nonsense."
"Are you sure? She was running late."
"I knew Rufus Patrick, safest engineer on the line."
"Then why'd she leave the tracks?"
"She had help from that son of a bitch unionist."
Bell said, "Show me where she left the tracks."
The director led Bell to the point where the tracks stopped on one side. Past the missing rail was a line of splintered ties and a deep rut through the ballast where the drive wheels had scattered the crushed stone.
"The sidewinder knew his business, I'll give him that."
"What do you mean, knew his business?" The portly official stuck his thumbs in his vest and explained.
"There are numerous ways to derail a train, and I've seen them all. I was a locomotive engineer back in the 80s during the big strikes, which got bloody, you may recall."
"No, you're too young. Take it from me, there was plenty of sabotage in those days. And it was hard on fellows like me that sided with the company, driving a train never knowing when strikers were conspiring to knock the rails out from under you."
"What are the ways to derail a train?" Bell asked.
"You can mine the track with dynamite. Trouble is, you have to stick around to light the fuse. You might make a timing device out of an alarm clock, giving you time to get away, but if the train is delayed, it'll blow at the wrong time. Or you set up a trigger so the weight of the engine detonates the powder. But triggers are not reliable, and some poor track inspector comes along on a handcar and blows himself to eternity. Another way is, you pry up some tie spikes and unscrew the bolts out of the fisheye that holds 2 rails together, reeve a long cable through those bolt holes, and yank on it when the train comes. Trouble is, you need a whole bunch of fellows strong enough to move the rail. And you're standing there in plain sight, holding the cable when she hits the ground. But this sidewinder used a hook, which is damn near foolproof."
The director showed Bell marks on the crosstie where a spike puller had dented the wood. Then he showed him scratches on the last rail made by a track wrench. "Pried up spikes and unbolted the fisheye, like I told you. We found his tools thrown down the embankment.
On a curve, it's possible the loose rail might move. But to be sure, he bolted a hook onto the loose rail. The locomotive caught the hook and ripped her own rail right out from under her. Diabolical.
What sort of man would know how to do something so effective?
Effective?
The director bridled.
You just said he knows his business.
Yes, I get your point.
Well, he could have been a railroad man, or even a civil engineer. And from what I heard of that cut-off tunnel explosion, he must have known a thing or two about geology to collapse both bores with one charge.
But the dead unionist you found was an electrician.
Then his radical unionist associates showed him the ropes.
Where did you find the unionist's body?
The director pointed at a tall tree 200 feet away. The boiler explosion had blown all its leaves off, and bare branches clawed at the sky like a skeletal hand.
Found him and the poor fireman top of that sycamore.
Isaac Bell barely glanced at the tree. In his pocket was James Dashwood's report on William Wright. It was so remarkably detailed that young Dashwood would get a slap-on-the-shoulder promotion next time he saw him. Inside of 8 hours, Dashwood had discovered that William Wright had been treasurer of the Electrical Workers' Union. He was credited with averting strikes by employing negotiating tactics that elicited the admiration of both labor and owners. He had also served as a deacon of the Trinity Episcopal Church in Santa Barbara. According to his grieving sister, Wright had been accompanying her son to a job in Los Angeles with a film laboratory. The office manager of the laboratory had confirmed they were expecting the boy to arrive that morning and had reported to Dashwood that the apprenticeship had been offered because he and William Wright belonged to the same Shriner's Lodge. So much for the wrecker killed in the crash. The murderous saboteur was still alive, and God alone knew where he would attack next.
Where's the hook?
Your men over there are guarding it. Now, if you'll excuse me, Mr. Bell, I've got a railroad to put back together.
Bell walked along the torn roadbed to where Larry Sanders from Van Dorn's Los Angeles office was crouched down inspecting a tie. Two of his heavy-set musclemen were holding the railway police at bay. Bell introduced himself, and Sanders stood up, brushing dust from his knees. Larry Sanders was a slim man with stylishly short hair and a mustache so thin it looked like he had applied it with a pencil. He was dressed similarly to Bell in a white linen suit appropriate to the warm climate, but his hat was a city man's derby and, oddly, was as white as his suit. Unlike Bell's boots, his shoes were shiny dancing pumps, and he looked like he would be happier guarding the lobby of an expensive hotel than standing in the coal dust that coated the busily trafficked roadbed. Bell, who was used to sartorial eccentrics in Los Angeles, paid Sanders' odd head and footwear little mind at first, and started on the assumption that the Van Dorn man was competent.
"Heard about you," Sanders said, offering a soft, manicured hand. "My boss wired from Sacramento, said you were coming down. I always wanted to meet you."
"Where's the hook?"
"The cinder dicks had already found it by the time we got here."
Sanders led Bell to a length of rail that had been bent like a pretzel. On one end was bolted a hook that looked like it had been fashioned from an anchor. "Is that blood or rust?"
"Didn't notice that."
Sanders opened a pearl-handled pocket knife and scratched at it.
"Blood. Dried blood.
Looks like he cut his hand on a burr of metal. Keen eyes, Mr. Bell."
Isaac ignored the flattery. "Find out who drilled this hole."
"What's that, Mr. Bell?"
"We can't haul in every man in California with a cut on his hand, but you can find out who drilled that hole in this peculiar piece of metal. Canvass every machine shop and blacksmith in the county. Immediately. On the jump."
Isaac Bell turned on his heel and went to talk to the railroad dicks, who were watching sullenly.
"Ever seen a hook like that before?"
"Hunk of boat anchor."
That's what I thought. He opened a gold cigarette case and passed it around. When the Cinder Dicks had smokes going and Bell had established their names, Tom Griggs and Ed Bottomley, he asked, "If that fellow in the tree happened not to wreck the Limited, how do you think the Rio wrecker got away after he ditched the train?" The railway cops exchanged glances. Ed said, "That hook bought him plenty of time." Then Tom said, "We found a track inspection vehicle tipped over the side in Glendale. Got a report someone stole it from the freight depot at Burbank."
"Okay.
But if he got to Glendale by handcar, he must have been 3 or 4 in the morning," Bell mused. "How do you suppose he got away from Glendale? Streetcars don't run that late."
"Could have had an automobile waiting for him."
"Think so?"
"Well, you could ask Jack Douglas, except he's dead. He was watching Glendale. Someone killed him last night. Ran him straight through like a stuck pig."
"First I heard," said Bell.
"Well, maybe you ain't been talking to the right people," replied the Cinder Dick with a scornful glance at the dandified Sanders waiting nearby.
Isaac Bell returned a thin smile. "What did you mean by ran through? Stabbed?"
"Stabbed?" asked Ed. "When's the last time you saw a stabbing dust both sides of a fella's coat? The man who killed him was either one strong son of a bitch or used a sword."
"A sword?" Bell repeated. "Why do you say a sword?"
"Even if he were strong enough to stick him in one side and out the other with a bowie knife, he'd have a heck of a time trying to pull it out. That's why folks leave knives in bodies. Damn things get stuck. So I'm thinking a long, thin blade like a sword."
"That is very interesting," said Bell.
"A very interesting idea. Anything else I should know?"
The Cinder Dicks thought on that for a long moment. Bell waited patiently, looking both in the eye. Superintendent Jethro Watts' orders from on high to cooperate did not automatically percolate down to the cops in the field, particularly when they ran up against a supercilious Van Dorn agent like Larry Sanders. Abruptly, Tom Griggs came to a decision.
"Found this in Jack's hand."
He pulled out a crumpled sheet of paper and smoothed it with his grimy fingers. Black lettering stood starkly in the sun. "Arise, fan the flames of discontent, destroy the favored few, so working men may live."
"I don't suppose it was Jack's," said Tom. "That old man weren't the sort to turn radical."
"Looks like," explained Ed, "Jack grabbed hold of it in their struggle."
Tom said, "Would have done better to grab his gun."
"So it would appear," said Isaac Bell.
"Strange thing is why he didn't."
"What do you mean?" asked Bell.
Tom said, "I mean you could make a mistake thinking that because Jack Douglas was 92 years old that he was asleep at the switch. Just last year, a couple of city boys came out to Glendale looking for easy pickings. Drew guns on Jack. He drilled one through the shoulder with that old hog leg of his and the other in the backside."
Ed chuckled.
"Jack told me he was getting soft. In the old days, he would have killed them both and scalped them. I said, 'You didn't miss by much, Jack. You plugged one in the shoulder and the other in the rear.' But Jack said, 'I said soft, not afflicted. I didn't miss. I hit him right where I aimed. Shows I'm turning kindly in my old age.' So whoever got the drop on Jack last night knew how to handle himself."
"Particularly," Tom added, "if all he had on him was a sword. Jack would have seen that coming a mile away. I mean, how does a man with a sword get the jump on a man with a gun?"
"I've been wondering the same thing," said Bell.
"Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much." He took out two of his cards and gave one to each. "If you ever need anything from the Van Dorn Agency, get in touch with me."
"I was right,"
Bell told Joseph Van Dorn when Van Dorn summoned him to San Francisco. But not right enough. He's thinking even bigger than I imagined.
Sounds like he knows his business, said Van Dorn, grimly echoing the Southern Pacific maintenance director. At least, enough to run circles around us.
But how does he get around?
Freight trains.
Bell answered, I've sent operatives to question the hobos in every jungle in the West. And we're asking every station master and ticket clerk in every station he might have been near who bought a ticket on a long-distance flyer.
Van Dorn groaned. The ticket clerks are even a longer shot than the hobos. How many passengers did Hennessy say the Southern Pacific carries per year?
100 million, Bell admitted.